WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Tim Curry became famous for his role in a cult classic, playing Dr. Frankenfurter in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Now, 30 years later, he's up for a Tony for his role in another, playing King Arthur in the Monty Python Broadway musical Spamalot. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Curry, recorded in March, just before Spamalot opened.
You grew up in England. Your father was a chaplain in the Navy.
Yeah.
Were you religious when you were growing up?
Rather not. As preachers' kids tend not to be, you know. I mean, my father was pretty chill about all of that. I mean, he wasn't... Methodism in England is a lot more relaxed than it is in the States. It's not as forbidding or as chilly. And he was a very liberal and very funny man. But, you know, I did willy-nilly show up, you know, to Sunday school morning and afternoon and went to hear him preach when he was on shore, because he was quite often at sea. And I spent my childhood in sort of various sort of naval bases until he died when I was quite young, when I was 12. And we moved to South London, and I went to boarding school. And I actually went to a school that was founded by John Wesley, I mean, who founded Methodism in, you know, the school, I think, started in 1784 or something and was founded for the sons of Methodist ministers. So I went to a fairly kind of churchy school, which has also turned out to be very kind of relaxed and liberal. And I was a cheerful agnostic, really, you know, from then on.
Still a cheerful agnostic?
Still a cheerful agnostic.
Did you have to go to church, and did you sing a lot in church?
Well, that was the great bonus, because the Methodist Church has a remarkable body of hymns, largely a great number of them by Charles Wesley. And so I sang in church from about, I don't know, six or seven, and I was a real boy soprano for, you know, until my voice changed.
It changed a lot, didn't it?
It did change quite a whole lot. I was very lucky because I had a great music teacher who sent away to Westminster Choral School for exercises when my voice started breaking, because, you know, so often people with wonderful boys soprano voices end up with no mature singing voices at all. And I managed to make that transition happily. And it's funny, when I was doing, I don't know whether this is interesting, when we were doing Pirates of Penzance, I had my first singing lessons, really. The lady who was doing them said, you know, we must work on your falsetto and get your range up. And I said, I don't have a falsetto. And she said, oh, nonsense, everyone has a falsetto. And I said, no, I really don't. And she made me find one, and she suddenly had this revelation one day, and she said, were you a boy soprano? And I said, yes, I was. And she said, you're in mourning for that sound, aren't you? And I realized that I was. I mean, it is a great sadness not to be able to make that extraordinary pure sound that you do make as a boy soprano.
That's actually
and
really
I
interesting,
just,
yeah.
It is. It's fascinating, isn't it? I think I just, you know, cut off that alley.
But you kept singing, didn't you?
I kept singing, yes, absolutely.
So did you go to, like, the loud, gruff rock band kind of singing afterwards?
Well, no, actually, I mean, you know, at 17 or 18, I was singing leader, and, you know, I was singing sort of classical music, really. But then, I guess, you know, the Beatles happened, and it was all over.
So what kind
that and Marlboro, you know?
Marlboro cigarettes.
It's funny because I actually quit smoking a year ago, and it was fascinating because within 3 weeks, my voice went back up a 10 and a half, and I remembered, and I heard the voice that I remembered myself singing in when I was 19 or 20.
Huh.
It's very odd, and it's a great warning to anyone to stay away from the demon tobacco, stupid drug that it is.
Now, I've read that you not only love Billie Holiday, but that you do Billie Holiday, and I wasn't sure whether that meant that you sing a lot of songs associated with her or whether you can do a good Billie Holiday impression.
Well, both, I hope. I don't know. I did a film for television in England called Blue Money, where I played a, you know, an impressionist. And I did a few singers, including Billie Holiday. Who else did I do? I did Ray Charles, and I did Elvis, and I don't know. Yes, I do Billie Holiday. Whether you would want to hear it now, I sort of doubt.
Well, but you'd be wrong, because I'd love to hear it if you were game.
Them that God shall give, them that's not shall lose. So them Bible says, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. Oh, it's much too early in the morning for you.
Did her singing influence you a lot? Even though
hugely. I didn't listen to anybody else for about 2 years when I was 18. I was just, you know, this awful, depressive teenager listening to Billie Holiday and wondering, you know, which gloomy Sunday I was going to throw myself under a car.
Oh, yeah. Which
you know how it is.
Which period were you mostly listening to of her?
Mostly the really early stuff. Mm-hmm. I find the later stuff very...
Because you were singing in the later voice.
Very unhappy.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the voice you were
well,
just
I'm singing
doing,
the
right?
later voice because, of course, I'm singing 8 times a week and
right.
I don't quite have the control over my voice that I do. Really, it doesn't actually sort of start to warm up until the evening. It's weird when you do a musical because you sing so hard and so regularly that your voice kind of goes into shock until it actually has to be produced for that evening.
Did you always know that you had that ability to mimic?
Yes, I think, you know, you have it or you don't. Hank Azaria, who is in this show, is an absolutely dazzling mimic and do anybody. You sort of have an ear or you don't, I think. And I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with... amusing other children when you're young and, you know, getting out of being hit.
Right. Is that effective for you?
I think it's effective for all childhood comedians. I think it's, you know, the root of a great deal of comedy.
Well, Tim Curry, I wish you really good luck with Spamalot.
Thank
you so much for
talking
with us. Thank
you very much indeed. My pleasure.
Tim Curry speaking with Terry Gross in March. He's nominated for a Tony for Best Performance by a Leading Actor in a Musical for his role in Spamalot. The ceremony is Sunday night. We just heard from Tim Curry, who's up for a Tony as Best Actor in a Musical for his role in Spamalot. He'll face tough competition from Hank Azaria, who's up for Best Actor in a Musical for his role in Spamalot. They account for 2 of Spamalot's 14 Tony nominations. Azaria has 4 roles in Spamalot, including Sir Lancelot and Tim the Enchanter. He's no stranger to playing multiple parts. On The Simpsons, he does the voices of Moe the Bartender, Chief Wiggum, Apu, and more. He's also been seen on the big screen, including roles in Shattered Glass, Dodgeball, Mystery Men, and The Birdcage. Terry Gross spoke with Azaria late last year.
How did you get to be on The Simpsons? And 2 of the voices you do are Moe, the Bartender, and Apu, who runs the convenience store, the Quickie Mart.
Yes, that's correct. Moe was the first voice I did. There's little Moe for you there. And Apu was actually the third voice, I believe, that I did. And I was 22 years old. This was a long time ago. I'm 40 now. I was 22 years old and I hadn't worked much. There was an original voice of Moe the Bartender that I guess they weren't too happy with. I wanted to replace. And I had done one other voiceover at the time for a failed Fox... kind of Roger Rabbit type pilot where I played the voice of this animated dog. And I guess they'd known me from that, so they called me. And it was just kind of like not an open call, but there was a lot of people there. And I went in. There was Matt Groening and a guy named Sam Simon who created the show. And I did this voice, and I was doing the play at the time in L.A. where I was playing a drug dealer, and I was sort of doing a bad Al Pacino impression in the play from Dog Day Afternoon. I was sort of talking like this, like kind of Al kind of sounded in Dog Day Afternoon. And I said, what about that voice? They're like, well, we want Mo to be gravelly. So I just made that voice gravelly, and it sounded like that. And they were just like, listen, that's great. Can you come record that right now? Literally on the spot. And I was like, yeah, sure. And I walked over with them on the Fox lot and recorded it. I had no idea. I hadn't read a script. I just recorded these lines that they needed and left, and frankly thought that was the last I'd hear of it. And they kept calling me back week after week. The next week I did Wiggum. Chief Wiggum, chief of police, talks like this. And then I did Apu. And then after about midway through the second season, they made me they gave me a contract. They made me a regular. By that point, I was doing like 5 or 10 voices.
Did you know you could do voices? I know you did that voice on that animated series that you mentioned, but had you done a lot of work like that before?
No, I hadn't done work like that before, but I'd certainly... My friends refer to me as the freakish mimic.
And what does that mean?
It means I can mimic a lot of people's voices almost exactly right away. And it is a little bit freakish, and I've always been able to do it. And... since I was a child, you know, to the point where I thought everybody, you know, when you're 5, you think everybody can do it. You don't realize it's a special talent. And it's just fortunate for me that I found, the ultimate great outlet for that particular weird skill, which is like a job like The Simpsons, where I must have done like 50 voices on that show by now in 16 years we've been doing it.
How did you come up with the voice of Apu? And he's an Indian in America who runs the Quickie Mart.
Correct. He really is just an Indian guy. I mean, in Los Angeles, pretty much every 7-Eleven or convenience store worker is either Indian or Pakistani or from this area. And when I first moved to L.A., these were the people I really interacted with mostly because I didn't know anybody. So I would talk to these guys. He's also kind of loosely based on Peter Sellers' character from the film The Party. I don't know if you know that, but Peter Sellers in that movie plays a character named Hrundi V. Bakshi, and he's a very open, sweet, kind, innocent guy. So sort of Apu's personality is kind of based on that character.
You've had to sing as Apu?
I have had to sing as Apu, it's true.
Is it hard to sing in character?
It's much easier for me to sing in character. It's much more difficult for me to sing in my own voice. It's much easier for me to sing as Wiggum or as Apu or even as Mo.
Why is that?
I think I'm just more comfortable with the mask, and the vocal mask. Chief Wiggum's like this. It's sort of easier to sing like this than it is to sing. I'm not embarrassed to do that, but I'd be embarrassed to do the same thing in my own singing voice. It's weird.
Is it any easier to do voices when you're doing it just as the soundtrack for animation? Is it harder to do it when your body's there and your body doesn't necessarily fit the voice?
No, yes and no, I guess. I find that, because I'm so vocally oriented that whenever I have to do a role in a movie or on TV that does have a very thick accent or some strange vocal quality, the body tends to follow naturally from the voice you get. When I did The Birdcage and I played a guy, a Guatemalan gay guy who talked like this, your body tends to follow the way that voice is. It's hard to like carry yourself in a very macho way when you're speaking like that.
Right. You played the Guatemalan housemaid in The Birdcage. Who did you base the character on?
I just tried to get a Guatemalan accent as authentically as I could and then sort of find a way to be as feminine as I could. And I sort of had it narrowed down to 2 voices, one that was a little tougher than that. And then I sort of presented the voice to a friend of mine who is actually a very beautiful drag queen in L.A. And he sort of selected the more fruity voice. He said, I wanted to make sure it was authentic. I wanted to make sure it wasn't too over the top. And he said that I should go with that one. And then I realized, though, after about 2-3 weeks of working on it, that it really kind of sounded exactly like my grandmother, which sort of, it really did. My grandmother, she's passed away, but I'm Sephardic Jewish, which is Spanish Jews, and she spoke this Spanish dialect, you know? And she was very sweet and loving and talked kind of like this. And it sort of realizing that it sounded like her also gave me a good piece of the character, because she was so maternal and mothering and loving that it was very, if I sort of had her mentality, it was easy to be kind of feminine, thinking that I was just kind of my grandma.
Can you tell us something about your childhood, where you grew up, what your parents did for a living when you were young?
I grew up in Forest Hills, New York, in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
My father is retired now, but he worked in the garment center. He had a couple of, at different times, he had different dress manufacturing businesses. And my mother was a housewife, and raised three kids, me and two sisters. I have two older sisters. My mother really, they both love show business, my parents, even though they weren't in it. They're tremendous aficionados of theater and opera and film and TV. They love everything. And they exposed me to a lot growing up, which I guess gave me some of the bug to do it. My mother actually was a publicist at Columbia Pictures in New York for a couple of years before she married my father. She's bilingual. She speaks Spanish. So she worked for their Latin country foreign distribution. She worked for publicity with South America and all the Spanish-speaking countries. And she loved it. And, you know, so I grew up really, we were always very, very aware of favorite actors and favorite movies and TV shows. And to this day, they see every film that comes out. They live in Miami now, you know, but they must see 3-4 films a week. And they know every television show.
So what was your first real break acting?
You know, I've had so many little breaks. I've had such a gradual career. I've skipped no steps. I mean,
how about commercials? Did you skip that step?
No, not at all. My first job was a commercial when I was 17 years old. The first audition I ever went on, it was a commercial for like Italian television. Once I got The Simpsons fairly steadily, I stopped going out on commercial auditions, which seemed crazy at the time because they needed the money, but I was making just enough from The Simpsons to live, and I found it so demoralizing. I just couldn't deal with it anymore. I used to always sound sarcastic when I read commercial copy. I'd be like, listen, this product's really great. And they'd be like, can you say that again? You sounded sarcastic. I was like, yeah, I can't seem to help it.
Right.
I remember one day they were doing some ad campaign for Jell-O, where they had this computer-generated animated character called Jell-O Man that was some gelatin O that lived in your refrigerator.
Uh-huh.
And they were looking for the voice of Jell-O Man. And I'm reading this thing. I'm like, well, he seems like a vagrant. I mean, he's living in your refrigerator. So I did some kind of voice like this or something. Like, hey, I'm Jell-O Man. I'm here in your fridge. And this woman, I did, you know, the take. And this woman went, you know, we do want Jell-O Man to have a bit of an edge. But the children should also like him. He's likable. He's likable. He's relatable. So, you know, do it again. And, you know, Jell-O Man's nice. He's a nice guy. You want him there. And I was listening to this direction, and I realized this was going to be the last moment of my commercial voiceover career. I really did. I realized I can't take it anymore. And I just said to this woman, you know that Jell-O Man's not real, don't you? And I left. And that was it for me.
Oh.
Hank Azaria speaking with Terry Gross. He's up for a Tony for his role in the Monty Python Broadway musical Spamalot. The Tony Awards are televised live this Sunday.